You're listening to the GP Supervisors Australia podcast, Improving the Learning Environment at Your Practice, presented by Dr. Michael Baker and Dr. Gerard Connors. We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this recording was produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present, future, and their families.
My name is Glenn Wallace. I'm the CEO of GP Supervisors Australia. This session, we're going to be going through the clinical learning environment, which was developed up through research that was conducted with GP supervisors to make sure that the framework was relevant to general practice. And what spawned that particular framework was an understanding that the accreditation of GP training practices was the common denominator between really high quality practices and practices that were still developing. And so it was not necessarily a good indicator of exactly what was missing, what was the special sauce that needed to be added to the training environment. So this hopefully adds an opportunity for the colleges and the RTOs and also yourselves to do a little bit of a self-reflection and assessment on the environment that we're going to run you through. Okay, so without further ado, I'm going to pass you over to your presenters tonight, Michael and Jared, and they're going to let you know about themselves and tonight's topic.
Thanks, Glenn. Yeah, Michael Baker's my name. I'm a GP. I live in Maffra in regional Victoria, down in Gippsland. 25 years the GP in Maffra, involved with supervision of registrars and interns and students and procedural work, involvement as a medical educator. And then over the last 5 years, I've sort of been a bit of freelancing a bit and returned to obstetrics and doing a bit more teaching. With nothing else to do in 2021 and COVID, I did a bit of further education in clinical education. That's sort of where this talk came from. Jared.
I've actually just retired as a regular doctor at the clinic that I worked at for 31 years. And I'm still doing a bit of work with them and with the General Practice Training Program, EVGPT, as SLO and a casual medical educator. And I'm on the GPSA board. This is my 8th year.
So could this be true? Could learning make you happy? I mean, by the time you get your fellowship, when you think of learning, I don't think you really think of happiness. I think when you think of learning, you're probably thinking of exams and late night study and everyone else or your mates perhaps going out and having a beer while you sit at home and study a bit more. And I don't think it was really until I got into my 40s and learnt to sail that it occurred to me that learning might make me happy. What about you, Jared? Has learning ever made you happy?
Funnily enough, studying for the FRACDP, I think, was probably the thing that really made me happy. When I was going through medicine, it was all a little bit remote, and it wasn't until I started seeing patients of my own that I really could see the relevance. So probably studying for the FRACGP, I'd say.
That's a nice segue that we had a new intern at the practice. Of course, they're very new, and the lady had otitis externa that proved a bit difficult to really get sorted out. And the lady was coming back for an appointment and the intern was very worried, you know, what have we got wrong? And the lady only came back to tell her that she was now better. And the intern was able to say, I've just cured my first patient. So I think she was learning and it was certainly making her happy. So if learning could make people happy, what about teaching? Does teaching make you happy? And I think most of us are probably in this game because you do enjoy teaching. Given that learning can make people happy, well, teaching them things, I think, can make us happy as well. And I think certainly if I'd put up a note there that said teaching makes me money, you'd probably all go, this guy has lost the plot. But I think we're probably doing it because we enjoy it. Which brings me to sort of the topic, what if your environment helps you teach? But I think a lot of the frustration we have as supervisors with our teaching stems from the environment they're working in, you know, whether we haven't got time, perhaps we just don't have enough rooms, perhaps we didn't get the registrar we expected to get. There's a lot of things that perhaps we feel we should be getting paid more that causes frustration and take away some of that enjoyment. I think getting a good learning environment or improving your learning environment can help with the enjoyment and lessen that other side of things. So that's what we're going to be talking about. We're going to think about, well, what is a learning environment? I think we've got to have some sort of idea of that before we start. We're going to talk through a bit about what makes a good learning environment. We've got a bit of a framework we're going to go through working that up. This brings us to a bit of a definition. What is a clinical learning environment? The definition, this was from 2009. And so a clinical learning environment it's a place that provides learners with an opportunity to experience the reality of professional practice in their chosen profession. And I don't think it's really hard to see that that fits a general practice registrar in a general practice pretty much 100%. They've certainly got an opportunity to see the reality when COVID hits and you've suddenly got to learn how to do a teleconference or whatever. So they're very much there. But perhaps if you're going to have an effective clinical learning environment, they're going to learn more and do that better if it's in a safe and supportive environment. The other idea I'd just like to touch on is this whole idea of a learning organisation. Because really, when we're talking about the learning environment, it's not just you and the registrar interacting. It's how the whole practice interacts as an organisation. Whether as a GP, you're learning. As a GP supervisor, you're always learning. And then your staff are learning, you know, whether that's the practice manager, whether that's the nurses, and it's a two-way street. And then there's the admin, and they're also learning both things that you're learning practice, but also how to make it run smoothly.
Good point here. A good relationship with your registrar helps, where they feel really welcome to raise issues and where they are participators in their learning rather than didactic learning, where they feel challenged and stretched and where what they're learning is very relevant to their work. And there was a study done in the Western Australian General Practice Training Program that found that the relationship between the principal supervisor and the registrar was probably the most important thing to help their learning. So in other words, if they didn't have a good relationship with their principal supervisor, it really did seriously affect their learning.
And that actually leads on to, given that we've got a bit of an idea of what a learning environment or clinical learning environment looks like, how should it work? And certainly that relationship is such a vital part of it. What experience has been of a good learning environment, clinical or otherwise? What about you, Jared? Have you got any to share?
I think I'll use my practice because it took us a while to get into the swing of it. This is 25 years ago. We didn't have the resources that GPSA have on their website. Initially, I think we had the supervisors and the practice manager involved with the registrar, but after a while, we realised that really, to make the registrar really feel safe and supported, we needed to ensure that all receptionists, all nurses really understood the role of the registrar and things like protected teaching time and not overloading them with patients, you know, here's another extra, things like that.
Yeah, communication is certainly a key part. Well, I'll tell a little story about Professor Glenn Moeller, who's the Professor of Obstetrics in Port Moresby. When I was doing my little return to obstetrics, I came across this fellow, Professor Moeller, at a workshop on vacuum, and it became evident this guy was the man. He was the world expert, really. I said to him, look, could I come up to Port Moresby and make myself useful and learn about vacuum? And he said, well, forget about making yourself useful, just come and learn. I did go up there for 3 weeks. You know, that attitude of a learning environment, they knew that they had medical students and then subsequently interns who were there for perhaps 10 weeks. And at the end of that time, the next time those doctors were going to see someone having a baby, they were probably going to be it with very little backup or none at all. And they were dedicated, the whole place was dedicated to making sure those people learned the skills they needed for where they were going to be next. But if I'm going to talk about what a good learning environment looks like, I've got to sort of break it into some chunks. And I sort of thought I was, you know, scratching around and perhaps thinking about the physical aspects, the administrative aspects, clinical aspects, psychological aspects, is it supportive, is it threatening? And then I discovered that someone else had put a bit of work into this, and that's probably what we're going to talk about next.
The GPSA board actually have just had our strategic planning weekend with a facilitator called Donna Cohen. And Donna has a science background, and she developed the best practice clinical learning environment framework for hospitals in Victoria. And Glenn knew of her, so he asked her if she could adapt a similar sort of thing for general practice. And it's probably taken a couple of years or more, and it's been developed with the assistance of the SLOs and other supervisors. So it's been a bit of backwards and forwards between Donna's team and people on the ground like us. So I think it's very practical for all, particularly new supervisors, but also for experienced supervisors who feel they could improve different parts of their practice.
So we're going to talk about that clinical learning environment and helping you think about where yours may well be doing well and where it could be improved. The practice values learning. I think that's really got to be number one. If your practice isn't valuing learning in the first place, it's pretty hard to go much further. Best practice clinical care. Well, it makes sense too. If you're going to be delivering learning, you really want to be teaching them good medicine or good clinical care. It being a positive learning environment, that's part of that enjoyment. It's seeing that people enjoy learning and that's a positive thing. And that's got to also mean that you're accepting that people won't get everything right every time. An effective general practice training provider relationship. We'll talk about that a bit more. That, of course, is all about to change, and there's no much point complaining about what you've got now. Start thinking about what you want out of the next one. Effective communication and then resources and facilities.
There was some research done at GPEX, which highlighted the sociocultural aspects, welcoming environment, being valued as one of the team, not considered just workforce, and practice-wide involvement in teaching. As principal education supervisor, I always took responsibility to make sure that everybody understood their role, and you have to have somebody leading the ship. In some practices, that might be, say, the practice manager setting up the teaching sessions, but I really do think the principal education supervisor's got to be overseeing everything, making sure that things happen.
So element one, that the practice values learning. And I think there's a very lot in this, really. You're looking at the whole practice values learning. Ideally, that is all the doctors, all the support staff, all the nurses. And that feeling that we've already talked about, that the learners are feeling valued and that the educators feel valued and that the whole practice feels that the time you're doing that is valued. It's not felt that if you're teaching, you're, you know, shirking seeing the patients, or you're not getting paid, it's expected to be unpaid work that you're doing.
I think that's an important point, Michael. We have heard instances where some practices don't pass on the teaching payment. And unfortunately, GP supervisors are not paid for supervision, something that we're, as GPSA, constantly working on with the Department of Health. But it's really important, if you are not an owner, that you get your just teaching payments, and if you are an owner, that you pass those teaching payments on to your supervisors or educators. You don't have to be a supervisor to be involved in the teaching of the registrar, the formal teaching.
Thanks, Jared. And I think that the teaching is planned is another way in which the practice demonstrates that the practice values learning, that it's not something sort of added on or done, you know, if you've got time for it, that it is scheduled, that is obviously not all of it, you still want those ad hoc interactions, that there is scheduled, protected teaching time. I don't know to what level of planning it should have as far as individual topics and such. I think that's another talk, that the time certainly is planned for. Two questions that came in. One was around, you know, how do you develop a good culture of learning? And I think, you know, it's obviously a challenging question to give a one-line answer to, but I think a lot of the key to that is ideally getting at least all doctors and ideally all staff committed to having registrars in the practice. But it takes time.
Our practice was very lucky in that most of the time, most of the doctors were happy to take questions from the registrar and not just the supervisors, because these days with people developing subspecialties like lactation consultant or skin cancer or travel medicine, it might be that you have a non-supervisor who has those skills who's happy to answer those questions. But certainly, it's great if all the doctors in the practice are happy to talk to the registrar, whether that be while they're consulting or in the tea room when we can get back to having lunch in the tea room.
I think, yes, getting everyone on side. And maybe the corollary to that is if you can't get everyone on side, at least know who are the more difficult people to bring across.
Yeah, and I think make the registrar aware of that. You know, don't call Dr. X during consultations, but they're very happy to talk to you at lunchtime. We had a doctor like that who did that.
So element two, best practice clinical care. And I think this also makes sense. If you're going to be teaching, then you want to be practicing good care in your clinic because that's what they're going to be seeing. As we, I think, know, it's not just what you sit down and teach someone in a tutorial. There's all those other aspects of general practice that they're seeing and watching happen. How you respond to phone calls, how you respond with how you look at your results, what happens if you get sick, how do you, there's a whole range of things that are different. Commitment to quality care, that the doctors are staffed and knowledgeable and competent. Perhaps you take it for granted, but I'll come back to that in a second. And how do you come up with, you know, if you're challenged, where do you get advice from? What sort of guidelines do you follow? What role do you show to your registrars? One of the things teaching can do is highlight if the practice isn't undertaking quality care, because you've got someone newly trained coming through asking questions. And if have you had that experience, Jared, or what are your thoughts on that?
Oh, sure, yeah. And look, in talking to supervisors and registrars when they've been at other practices, you know, they might say, well, you know, I didn't feel very comfortable because one doctor wanted me to prescribe all these opiates or benzodiazepines. That is where it's really good to have all the doctors in the practice on the same page.
Yeah, and of course it can create friction if maybe there's someone who the practice is ignoring to some extent and not having that difficult conversation. This may in fact bring it to the fore and make it have to happen, which might not be a bad thing. positive learning environment. And again, raises some really good points for getting things off to a good start. Right at the start there, the environment is welcoming. Learners receive an appropriate orientation and induction to the practice are included in relevant team-based activities. So I think that appropriate orientation and induction is just so vital. It's right at the start. It sets them up for how organised is this practice? How are they onto things? Are they ahead of the game and telling me all the stuff I need to know, or I've got to find it out? Some of it can be judged by when a new learner comes into your practice. Are you sighing and going, oh dear, I've got to go through that induction again? Or is it a well-oiled process? And I know in our practice, initially I was that one that would sigh. And then when we had interns coming, so we knew we were going to have a new intern every 10 weeks, and we really nailed down and got very organised about orientation. And suddenly it did change from being a groan to a very well-oiled, very slick. You know what time you had set aside. You know the topics you had to cover. It just made such a difference. You're nodding your head there, Jared.
Yeah. Look, I'm the GPSA checklist for orientation of registrars. Most RTOs, or all RTOs, I think, have a checklist within their practice guide. But I think you'd be interested to have a look at the GPSA one.
And so, yeah, there's a lot in this topic, because the next one is the environment safe? And I know this has been quite a focus. How do you know they're safe in there? Setting up that sort of non-judgmental thing where you've got to let them make some level of mistake, I guess, have some independence, but having realistic expectations. Are you undertaking observation of the registrar? Are you doing random audits? How are you actually checking that what they're doing is safe? And then even that cultural, professional, physical safety, emotional safety, psychological safety is the term I'm looking for. If something's happened, I mean, how safe are they going to feel if you have to pull them up for that or discuss that with them, have that difficult conversation? How are you going to feel about that as well? How's the whole practice going to feel?
And one way to start, if you've got a GPT1 or a GPT2, any level really, but particularly GPT1 and 2, is ask them to discuss every patient for the first week at the end of the consultation. So what's called parallel or wave consulting.
Yep.
And that really gives you a pretty good idea within a week of how competent that person is. Then they gradually gain confidence over the next, usually 2 or 3 months for GPT1. But you'd be worried if they weren't asking you questions in that period of time.
And perhaps that's a good time to think about the second question we got asked in advance, which was learning structure and support versus in the deep end. That thing of, well, how much support and structure you provide versus how much independence you give the registrar, how much throwing them in the deep end. And I think it really has to be an individualised process. And certainly at first, you're going to really want quite close support and structure. And I would encourage wave consulting, as Jared suggested, where you initially have all the patients they've seen presented to you and allow for that in schedule. And then you make a decision about how much leeway you can give the person. That might be a decision you can make very quickly if they're GPT 3 or 4. It might be something that takes quite a while if they're GP 1.
And learners and staff in general feel confident knowing how and when feedback is going to occur. Now, I think in all RTOs, there's 2 formal feedback times, usually around 6 to 8 weeks and then around 5 months. But registrars really like informal feedback. And I usually had my room either next to or the one 2 doors down from the registrar. If I was just walking past the registrar's room and their door was open, I'd always just pop in for a minute, how are you going, any problems, and give them any positive feedback I'd heard about them. And if it was more constructive, or in brackets, negative feedback, then it's best not to do that while they're consulting, arranging the time where you both have time.
I certainly have had registrars who are lacking in self-confidence. You have to make yourself a little bit more difficult to get to. You know, someone would ring early and I'd say, well, you know, you might have to specify, look, before you ring me, you must have this, this and this. You know, I want your plan before you ring me. And some people do need pushing, and others, I haven't had much experience with others who are overconfident and needing to be pulled up. And that's probably a harder thing to
manage. I've had 1 or 2, and you do need to speak to them about it and just say, look, you know, I would expect that you would be discussing some of the more difficult cases with them. And one way of overcoming that is to do something like random case analysis, where you just pull a session and just go through each patient. And that gives you a pretty good idea of how they're going. And then also maybe looking at their results and how they deal with their results.
Element 4, an effective general practice training provider relationship. But obviously with the changes coming up, it's less than 12 months away. I don't think there's much point complaining about whatever you've got at the moment. I'd be encouraging people to think about what they want out of the next arrangements, and having talked to the colleges about what they're expecting to put in place. But perhaps this is a good framework for having you think about that if you do have any interaction with the people who are going to be setting things up in roughly 12 months' time. Obviously, you want an organisation that's respectful of you, that is working together to be able to communicate with them. There should be someone clearly who you can communicate and backwards and forwards. And there should certainly be written agreements in place. I mean, how detailed they have to be, I guess, depends on your experience and their experience, but there's got to be something to go back to if you're struggling with that. And I guess GPSA would have a lot of experience in this area.
Yes, there's a fantastic resource, which is a call for help list to run through with your registrar. My general practice training program, EVGPT, has a list of types of cases that you would ask your registrar to call you for. So chest pain, acute abdomen, very sick child, things like that.
Does GPSA get much questions from supervisors about complaints about the training organisations? Does that form part of their role?
I think Glenn has a constant stream of issues in relation to supervisors having difficulty with registrars. They look for advice, and then also training providers do have to refer to Glenn sometimes for advice. And then sometimes GPSA and GPRA have to get together and be mediators. So yes, there is a constant stream of issues, as you can imagine.
So element five, and we've really touched on this quite a lot, effective communication processes. I guess if I was picking element one as such a vital part of getting things working, then this one really just comes out all the time. Communication facilitates improved teaching and learning. Well, it's such a vital part of it. Feedback, whenever the feedback word's used, everyone sort of groans, but it should be specific, timely, constructive, supportive, balanced and two-way. And you know, thinking about setting up, as already mentioned, people like to know when the formal feedback's going to be due, but also establishing when that opportunity for feedback is going to come up and how are you going to be communicated with while they're seeing patients at the end of the day, the start of the day. I know one of my learning experiences was if you were really only available for, initially with early registrars, really, if they wanted to catch me about something that was non-clinical, then it tended to be at the end of the day when I was finished and they were finished, which means just when you didn't want to hear about anything at 6:30 at night, that's when you heard their problems. And of course, because it was an awkward time to get hold of me, the problems got big before they came to my attention. We reset up a set aside initially, basically half an hour a week initially, to getting feedback in the early weeks, and it extended that and made it less often, but it had already established that ability to interact. And I think that was enormous in making little problems stay little and not letting them get to be big problems. And of course, yeah, then it facilitates effective operation of the practice. It's just so vital.
Often your practice manager is the person the registrar might go to for non-clinical concerns. So keep in touch with your practice manager very closely. Just in terms of feedback, of course, that even though people do groan historically, sick of feedback, I think it's probably one of the most important skills that we can learn, and it's best learned by practice. There's at least one webinar on the GPSA website on feedback if you, by chance, haven't already had a feedback session with your RTO.
And we've come to the final element, resources and facilities. And perhaps this is the hardest one to do something about. Certainly, having appropriate resource and facilities, having a room, lovely if they can have a room they call their own. Often they've got to share it. Needs the internet now, no question about that. Do you still need a library with paper books in it? Well, maybe not. And, of course, something reasonable in way of a tea room, I guess it's going to be needed again. Perhaps they're starting to use tea rooms again now.
But we started off with four consulting rooms and a very tiny procedure room. And we then, several years later, went to eight, and several years after that went to 12, and now I think we're up to about 16 consulting rooms. So we've just gradually built it up over time. And it's really important that your registrar is just treated the same as any other doctor. So in other words, don't have them changing rooms every session. If they're full-time in your practice, well, they should be either having a room of their own most of the time, but ideally all the time. And if they're part-time, then no more onus than the average part-timer. Same with rostering.
This way of breaking up into elements and having this as one of the elements is really useful if you sit down as a practice and have a think about how you can improve that learning environment, because it may be that increasing the resources and facilities is something that when you go through that clearly needs to be done. And as Jared suggests, if that's the case, then there's generally a way to plan on how to increase the number of rooms along those things. It might, a bit like getting everyone on side, might take some years. But identifying the need is the first step in doing something about it.
Glenn has just made a point. Getting on top of issues as early as possible is absolutely key. And I think he is very much speaking from experience there as somebody who's had a lot of issues brought to him by RTOs and supervisors. You know, there's always two sides to a story. Glenn is very good at trying to be fair, and some RTOs will sort of take the side of the registrar, and it's good to look at both sides.
Okay, we're going to get you to evaluate which area you think your practice is doing best, which area you think your practice most needs improvement. One, the practice values learning, best practice clinical care, positive learning environment, effective general practice training provider relationship, effective communication processes, appropriate resources and facilities. Which area do you see your practice doing best in?
So we've got positive learning environment in the lead. Coming up the rear, we've got effective communication processes, best practice clinical care, and the practice values learning. The two least chosen options appear to be at this stage an effective general practice training provider relationship and appropriate resources and facilities.
So people feel they're doing best in a positive learning environment. That's the overwhelming leader there. The other question, which area do you most see your practice needing improvement?
What we are seeing in the lead is best practice clinical care, appropriate resources and facilities, followed by effective communication processes and an effective general practice training provider relationships.
Best practice clinical care, okay. So people can see improvements needed there. That's got me interested.
I think that there's probably an opportunity there, and that is to role model asking. And that is that GPs at all stages don't always know every question. Jared Ingham has said on a number of occasions that the longer he's in general practice, the less he feels like he knows completely. And so perhaps that reflects that there is a hell of a lot to know and to keep on top of. But it also is an opportunity to emulate and reflect with registrars just exactly that.
Yeah, totally agree. In our practice, the most senior doctor is not afraid to ask anybody a question. Have a look at this rash. What do you think?
Those just come from the CCU is the one that knows all the current protocols.
That's right.
Yeah.
And patients love it. They absolutely love it. Yeah.
What I would encourage you to do, I think this is a great resource to print it out and share with your colleagues. Would they have a look at it and bring it back to a practice meeting, perhaps, and have a look through it? Perhaps it would help focus the practice. Perhaps it might bring up some things that need discussion, like clinical care. I think it's a really useful tool in that, and I think that's really the way that I would see this being very useful. And, of course, for new practices, I think that's another way of looking at it.
It is an extraordinary amount of resources, an extraordinary amount of coordination. So I'd very much encourage you to have a look at this, particularly if you're a new practice. This really gives you a fantastic head start. And if you're an existing practice that has identified one or two of those areas after you have your practice meeting, as Michael has talked about, then you can hone in on which one of the elements that you need to.
So we've talked about the concept of learning environment, giving you a chance to evaluate your own learning environment and suggestions for where you might go from there. And hope we get better learning environments, happier teachers, happier learners. Question about that comment that if you do a really comprehensive orientation, then they do get overwhelmed. And I think it's that whole challenge of what do they need to know on day one? Well, they need to know everything, but they don't remember any of it. Yeah, I think that, well, I suppose chunking is a term that comes to mind, where there's things that they know and then they see a few patients and then suddenly a whole lot of other stuff that they ignored, they suddenly find is relevant and then they're motivated to learn that. You know, I sort of view it as about a six-week process, really, that while they work their way through it.
The way that we've prepared the Before the Registrar Starts documentation allows for practices to get the registrar ready even before they've attended the practice. So it's about doing things in a stepwise approach, making sure that they have access to policies and employment paperwork before they start, so that they aren't overwhelmed trying to do everything on day one.
Thank you, Glenn. And thank you to everybody.
Thanks very much, Michael. Hey. Thanks, Jared.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating and/or a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your colleagues. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic, you can reach out to us via our social channels. Simply search GP Supervisors Australia on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram or Twitter. GP Supervisors Australia is supported by funding from the Australian Government under the Australian General Practice Training Program.